Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Steve Bryant, Paul Daly, and Chad Fiedler have taken the hard road towards pulp heroes. Instead of another superhero book, they created the character of Athena Voltaire, a cargo pilot covering the pre-World War II globe in search of adventure. Her first tales happened online, and now they appear monthly, courtesy of the publisher Ape Entertainment. This month, a special trade collecting the online adventures of Athena Voltaire is coming out, with the new monthly wrapping up its first arc in January, Flight of the Falcon. Today, we speak with artist Steve Bryant, the creator of Athena Voltaire. Let's start with your beginnings in art in Bloomington, because I don't think people realize what a hotbed the Bloomington Normal area of Illinois is for great artists.
Well, it's where Illinois State University is, where I didn't actually go there, but I've known a lot of people that came through ISU and Illinois Wesleyan. I think Don Kramer went to Illinois Wesleyan, and Tim Bradstreet, a local guy from here. And I had met Tim through some mutual acquaintances, and he hooked me up with a local publisher that did role-playing games called Game Designers Workshop.
I remember it well. I went to Illinois State, and I was down there.
Okay, cool, yeah. And, Tim got me on there as a graphic designer. He'll say he just put in a word for me, but, as far as I'm concerned, he got me the gig.
That's cool.
And, I started doing graphic design there. After 2 or 3 months there, the person who was the art director just stopped coming in, and suddenly I was the art director.
Wow.
I'm like Conan the Usurper. Moved right in.
What were the games that you guys were designing back then?
They were doing a science fiction game called Traveler, one called Space 1889, which was steampunk stuff.
Okay.
A game called Twilight 2000, which, bear in mind, this is 1989, so, 2000 was still the distant future. And, that was like paramilitary stuff. And, it was a lot of fun to do that. I eventually weaseled my way into doing some illustration. I was a GDW for almost 4 years. And then, excuse me while I lose my voice, I moved up to Chicago at a publisher called FASA, who published games Shadowrun and Battletech, stuff like that.
I remember
again,
those.
Pardon me?
Yeah, I remember games like that, absolutely. Okay. Well, of course, Battletech, certainly.
Well, yeah, giant robots, you can't beat it, right? But I ended up, again, primarily doing graphic design there and illustration on the side, and dove into freelance illustration for, role-playing games in about 96. Yeah, probably about 96, and did a bunch of black and white.
Was it difficult to pick up the storytelling aspects of, sequential art as opposed to just doing illustration for game design?
Yes and no. I've read comics since I was five, and, it's always been something that I've loved. I never had the guts to work up samples for them until around 2000, 2001. I'd read Eisner's comics and sequential art a bajillion times.
Okay.
And, Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, and I knew the people that I liked, so I kind of jumped right in. I there's still some awkwardness, I think, in the early samples, but, they're not going to see print anywhere. But it was a pretty easy transition, and actually, again, that's where Bradstreet comes back into the picture, because I had moved back down to central Illinois from the Chicago area. He was still living here, and he looked at my samples all the time, so he was really helpful. Stuff that got the best response in my portfolio would be, like, illustrations from the gaming stuff in the back, where I wasn't trying to do superheroes.
Okay.
So, for a long time, I had thought about wanting to do this dream project, which was Athena Voltaire. And finally I just said, well, when I'm sending in samples, I can be one of 150 guys that send in Batman or Starman or Wolverine or whatever. But if I brand myself with this character, maybe there's a chance I can be remembered a little more. And plus, it plays more to my strengths rather than, I love reading superheroes, I'm just not good at drawing them.
Really? Okay. Because you would think that the heroic figure, pretty much, if you strip away the costume, is still the heroic figure or whatever, but...
Well, I guess I should clarify. It's landscape was a little bit different in 2000, 2001, in terms of what was acceptable for comic style. Because it seems like in the last 3 years, you've got guys that may not work in quite a traditional, superhero type style, like Steve Epting doing Captain America. I mean, he's channeling Al Williamson and doing it brilliantly. I mean, it's gorgeous. But I don't know if, Steve Epting pre-cross-gen would have been able to do that. And, I don't know the guy. I just happen to love his work. But it just seems to me like Marvel and DC both have kind of changed the way that they're letting some of the superheroes be done. Not everything is quite as exaggerated. And, maybe it's, post-John Cassavetes and Brian Hitch, where you're seeing more fabric of the clothing rather than everything just being the musculature. Because that's kind of where I fall down when I start putting in the musculature. But, you've got guys like Steve Epting and Michael Lark and guys like that are kind of a step away from the way that everything was looking, around 99, 2000. I kind of tried to move away from that back then. And then, all the cross-gen guys, your Eptings, your Butch guys, guys like that kind of let some of the older influences come through, I think.
Sure. Did you try to get over to cross-gen? Certainly they were printing a lot of genres that would be in your wheelhouse, given what you do with Athena Voltaire.
We submitted for their creator-owned line, but I never tried to get on staff. At the time I was married, and my wife was the big breadwinner. So it just didn't make a lot of sense. Of course, now cross-gen's no more, and so is the marriage. So,
Is
the one half a dozen of the other.
Well, let's talk about the woman that is still in your life, Athena Voltaire. Where was the inspiration for this character in particular?
I was teaching at a park district type of program in the Chicago suburbs, and they were doing a teacher show, and everybody had to bring in, a couple of pieces framed. And I had this image that I'd done for a business card that was like a 1950s retro space chick. And I didn't want to call it Untitled, so for some reason I just called it Athena Voltaire Space Ranger, because the name just made me laugh my ass off. And I really liked that name. So it just kept, bouncing around my head, but I'm not the best guy in the world at doing hardware and spaceships and stuff like that. So I thought, well, what do I want to draw? And that's kind of Pulp Jungles, Al Williamson, Mark Schultz, that kind of stuff just came right to me. And, it turns out that Athena Voltaire is a pretty good name for an Indiana Jones type of character.
So did you start off, you've got the concept. How early did your other collaborators come into the process?
Really early with Paul Daly.
Okay.
When I got the name, this would have, I guess, been 96. Like I said, it was kind of on the back burner years until I got enough rejection that I realized, screw it, I'm just going to do this. And I guess when I got the idea, I kept thinking this would be a really cool comic. But not only at the time had I not drawn comics, I'd never written either. So I called up a friend of mine, Paul Daly, who, again, 6 degrees of Bradstreet, I had met through Tim.
Okay.
And he was doing gaming illustration. When I was an art director, I gave him a lot of work. And I knew that he was steeped in this kind of stuff. And all I knew was that I wanted to do an Indiana Jones type of female, but I didn't want her to be an archaeologist, so I, at the time just suggested pilot, not really realizing that I'd have to draw planes. Sometimes I'm not very bright. But I gave that to Paul, and he starts spewing all this stuff. She could be like Pancho Barnes and blah, 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 blah. And, I just thought he was pulling it out of his hat. Come to find out, he had done a pitch for a licensed property a few years before, and this was one of the supporting characters he had in it. So, we kind of grafted what I wanted to draw with, all this stuff that Paul had. And as he's throwing all this stuff at me, I realized, originally it was going to be my little self-indulgent dream project, but you're throwing a lot of stuff at this. I think you should be, co-creator, co-owner. And so that's kind of where we went from there. And then when I actually started doing the pages, I was working at a place that did clip art, and one of the other guys on staff was Chad Fiddler, who later went on to color our early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Chad had just amazing chops at computer stuff, so I asked him to color some stuff for me, and I could not picture the book being in black and white after that. Long story short story long, something like that.
Now, in our conversations, you know I'm a huge fan of the 30s and 40s serials, and I expected that you were as well, but you tell me that really that's Paul's influence.
Oh, yeah, Paul's steeped in that. He's probably got every genre film committed to memory at this point. You know, I'm coming at it more from a pulp point of view, like Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard and stuff like that. Paul is, that's why I originally mentioned it to him, because he was so steeped in all this stuff.
You mentioned Al Williamson, and I know you're a Frazetta fan as well. Do you have old copies of any of, you know, great Williamson stuff? I mean, I have a reprint that came out, Bud Plant put it out in the 70s, of Thunda, the Frazetta.
The one.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just great. I mean, and it's really gorgeous pen and ink Frazetta in his, you know, comics prime. And it really is one of the best things that I have. So do you have either originals or reprints of things of those eras?
I've got some of the Williamson Flash Gordons.
And great stuff.
They're just beautiful. My favorite Frazetta book is called Untamed Love.
Yes.
The Eclipse one. You've got that?
I'm aware of it. I've seen work from it. In fact, I think Bud Plant also released a collection of Untamed Love around the same time as he did that Thunder one from the 70s.
Oh, it's just beautiful stuff. It's like some of it is civilian stuff, but some of it is like jungle stuff, and it's got the Frazetta fades, and it's just stunning. And the reproduction's great. So that's one of the things that, you know, I'm always looking at. Insight Studios did Al Williamson Adventures a few years ago, which is great. And Dark Horse has The Hidden Land. You know, a lot of the Williamson stuff is in print now. Vanguard did the sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
They also did that great Gray Morrow sketchbook.
Yeah.
And a Wally Wood one. So, you know, a lot of the guys that I love, you know, have stuff there. I've got the Williamson Russ Cochran Star Wars daily strips.
Yep.
Just beautiful stuff in there. I wish somebody would reprint. He did 13 years on Secret Agent X9, the daily strip,
mm-hmm.
from like 67 to 80. And then he moved over to doing Star Wars. And it's absolutely my favorite stuff of his. Just gorgeous ink work. And I'd love to see somebody print that.
It's amazing when you look at the adventure strips from really the 30s through the 60s in America, and then luckily I think the tradition continues in England, because I'm wondering, do you ever read any of the Modesty Blaze stuff and the reprints that Titan Books have been churning out the last few years?
I've got two of them, and I'd love to get more of them, because those are beautiful. Hell, there's so much good stuff that's not in print. I'm thrilled about Checker doing Milton Caniff's Steve Canyon.
Yeah, I've been getting all of those too. Oh, absolutely, every year of them, they're great.
And you know, stuff like that. I'd love to see somebody reprint. I don't know if you're familiar with Noel Sickles.
I know the name. Give me the strip.
He did Scorchy Smith. He replaced
sure.
the original guy, who wasn't as good. But Sickles brought in this real illustrative sense. Gorgeous stuff. Thank God we're getting a bunch of Toe stuff in print.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other stuff.
How about Frank Robbins? You know, it's funny. In the 70s, he did so much work for Marvel and was doing Captain America and the Invaders and stuff. And it looks really odd compared to what other 70s books were coming out from Marvel. But I reached back, and he had a Steve Canyon-like strip from the 50s called
Johnny Hazard.
You got it. There you go.
You and I are about the same age.
Yep.
I say that like it's a newsflash to you. I'm obviously conscious that we're being recorded. Both John and I are the same age. But I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, I hated Robin on Cap and the Invaders. I just didn't get it. It was like sometime in the last 5 to 10 years that I actually saw the Johnny Hazard stuff. And I got it. You know, I completely get it now.
Yep. I felt the same way, man.
Oh, it's just, yeah, I mean, your assessment about Caniff is right on the money. And just beautiful loose gestural brush quality that, you know, is in his work. I mean, the best descendant that I can think of that's doing that kind of work with those kinds of sensibilities is Darwin Cook.
Very much so, yeah.
Who's just abso-fucking-lutely brilliant. but that's another rant.
No,
I just kind of trail off, and you have to kind of guide me back.
No, this is good. The tangents are welcome. Always welcome on Word Balloon. That's what we do. Have you had the opportunity to talk with Williamson or Cook or any of these guys at cons?
Actually, a friend of mine assisted Williamson. So a guy named Alan Nunes worked in Williamson's Honesdale studio for a couple of years. And I had the opportunity to meet Williamson. And, I mean, at the time, this would have been 92. My stuff was awful. Just terrible work. But, I mean, he was very gracious. That's actually he gave me one of the 1960s Flash Gordon comics from King Features that I got.
Sure.
He had a big stack of them. It was like, you know, it was his parting gift to people. I had to pick out a couple of pages, and here's a Flash Gordon.
Wow.
You know, the pages he gave out were things that he was inking. I would have loved to have gotten, you know, Secret Agent X9 or something. But, I guess he's been selling those in the last few years. But, I meeting him was a thrill. I've had the, again, through Alan Nunes, I've had the pleasure of meeting Mark Schultz, who is just incredibly talented, a gracious individual. He wrote the introduction for our webcomics collection.
That's fantastic.
He's a sweetheart of a guy, and he's very generous in complimenting work that may not necessarily need to be complimented.
He's going to be doing one of the Bad Planet covers that when the series gets back on track. I know Louis LaRocca was sick for a while. Steve Niles and Tom Jane, the Punisher, did that sci-fi thing, and they got a lot of great artists to do both covers and, you know, LaRocca doing the interiors. And I know Mark has the one cover because it's in the Word Balloon magazine.
Right, and I think it was in the ad in the first issue of Black Planet, Bad Planet, right?
Yeah, you might be right.
And this goes back to our 6 degrees of Tim.
That's true. That's right, back to Bradstreet. Very true.
Everything goes back to you, Tim, if you're listening.
How long of a run online before ending up finally in print?
I think we were online we launched in 2002, and we jumped around from a few different sites. Our initial site died in 2003, so we relaunched at the sister site. We started on a site called Adventure Strip, and then we moved over to Modern Tales and relaunched and reran the first adventure so we could try to build up ahead of steam because we never had a good deal of lead time. And we ran at Modern Tales for about a year or so and then moved over to the Action website called Graphic Smash. All told, we were on for about 4 years.
Okay.
A few stops and starts. And then it comes out to be in about two adventures, about 80 to 90 pages of material.
Okay, that's cool. The trade is coming out this month, December?
Actually, right before you called, I got a call from Brent Irwin, our publisher at Ape, and Diamond got their copies today. So I think it'll be out Thursday after Christmas.
Fantastic. The first three issues of the ongoing Ape story, I've read those and I've enjoyed them. I like the characters a lot, and I especially enjoy the female Nazi villain. And, you know, as I've told you before, it immediately makes me think of the cult films that I grew up on and stuff. And I couldn't help but think of Ilsa of the SS, one of the more notorious cult films of the 80s.
It's funny you mention that because someone pointed me to Ray Tate of SilverBulletComicBooks.com has reviewed the book, and every time he's referring to the SS, you know, Major Hannah von Helm, he refers to her as Ilsa as well.
Ilsa the She-Wolf, yeah.
So we've tapped into an archetype.
Oh, yeah. How much more in the first arc here?
The first series, Flight of the Falcon, will wrap with issue 4.
Okay.
And then we've got, I think, 2, maybe 3 months off. The next series is called The Legend of Mu King.
Okay.
It starts in March of 2007. The whole pitch on that one is there's a link between the... I'm drawing a blank, I'm sorry.
No problem, man.
The alchemy process of creating the legend of the golem, and someone is trying to do that in... a Chinese warlord is trying to do that with the terracotta warriors. And so there's going to be a big throwdown in, you know, the South China Sea and all that good stuff. So we kind of get away from the Nazis for this one and move into kind of a Cherry and the Pirates type thing.
Sure. Well, that's the great thing about, I think, the backdrop. You've got the whole world, and you've got at least two decades, if not more, of you know, any possible adventures for her. And who knows? I mean, you know, maybe you'll have more of a fantasy element where you might see her even beyond the obvious time period of the 30s and the 40s.
Well, the world was just a lot bigger back then, you know, it seemed like, with, you know, not satellite communications. And it just felt like the exotic stuff, the exotic uncharted parts of the world were a lot more exotic.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're talking the early 1930s, you're maybe 30 years removed from the end of the Wild West.
That's true.
You know, when did the Wild Bunch take place? Like 1907?
Right, right.
So you're looking at 25, 30 years later, and, you know, 25 years ago now would have been 1982, 1981. Sorry, I'm already in 2007. You know, it doesn't seem like that far away to us. So in the context of Athena's world, you know, it's not that far away from them, the Wild West.
Do you ever pull back to, like, sources like National Geographic or anything that was coming out back then, which really was the only connection to some of the far-off places that you go to?
I think, again, going back to Paul Daly in the library at you know, Alexandria, he's got everything. And I know that he has more National Geographic than a human being should have. And he'll photocopy stuff and mail me stuff. So I'm sure that, you know, that's in his bag of tricks. I ended up tossing a lot of my geographics. I'm ashamed to say, when I moved out for the divorce, just, you know, there's only so much room I can have for books.
Sure.
And if one of these rickety shelves falls on me while I'm working, you know, it's lights out.
How does the plotting work between the two of you then?
Well, with the Flight of the Falcon, what happened was we initially had it down as a 96-page one-shot. You've had Jeff Parker on the show. The Inner Man is one of my all-time favorite OGNs. To me, that's just brilliant. And that's kind of the route we wanted to take. We wanted to do a 96-page standalone. And everybody we pitched at wanted a mini-series, and most of them said, for European translation, it really should be like five issues because nobody there wants a 96-page book. So, you know, I looked at what we had, and we had a lot of seven panels to a page type stuff because there was a lot of story going on. So Paul had written a detailed script, and then I rebroke it and found new cliffhangers, and I expanded a couple of scenes, but it's still essentially what Paul laid out. And the process for Mu King is Paul's writing it and I'm drawing it. So, you know, it's a little more traditional role situation.
Does he send in a full script, or do you guys how do you guys
Yeah, he'll send a full script, and like on the script I just got, there were a couple of questions where I was thinking, you know, I'm a little unsure of what you're asking here. Here's what I'm seeing. You know, we'll kind of flag different things that if there's something that I don't think I can draw right, he'll either send me reference or explain it, or I can, you know, reframe it. So it's a good back and forth.
That's cool. And what is the potential response from Europe? Have you gotten any bites yet for you know, the eventual trade of either, you know, the current story going on or the webcomics that you had?
Right when we launched at Speakeasy last year, my lawyer was going to, I'm going to mispronounce it, Angoulême.
Okay.
The big French convention.
Oh, okay.
And they didn't want to see anything that wasn't complete yet. So, you know, now that we're getting the web trade done and, you know, we're going to finish up Flight of the Falcon here shortly, we should hopefully be able to sell it to foreign markets as well.
That's great. Are there current European artists that you can point to that you really enjoy seeing their stuff?
I'm gonna drop the ball on some of the names. I like Jordi Brunet a lot.
You bet.
You know, of course, Mobius. I mean,
sure.
I like the Mobius stuff, but my favorite stuff is his Jean Girard stuff.
Lieutenant Blueberry.
Exactly. Oh, that's so nice. well, did you see the first issue of Seven Soldiers of Victory where J.H. Williams was doing Mobius?
Yeah.
Did you see it?
Yes.
It was just beautiful.
Yes.
Those guys.
That's cool.
Is it John M. Burns that I'm thinking of? Yeah. He did a bunch of strip work in England, and he just did the first three issues of Marvel's Sable and Fortune.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was so disappointed, and I told Cassata that, you know, they didn't finish that painted. And obviously it must have been due to sales that the final issue ended up being, you know, just a regular comic-style book. But, yeah, that painted book was really gorgeous. And
well,
I was...
Yeah, and I mean, the really strange thing with that kind of book is if you look at what John M. Burns does, you know, he's kind of in that same illustration school as Robert McGinnis, who I don't know if you're familiar with, did a bunch of pulp pictures, pulp covers in the 60s, 50s, 70s.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
He's obviously an influence on Phil Noto and Sean Phillips. Well, John M. Burns is right in that same school, and I think a lot of the people that really dig Sean Phillips and Phil Noto would probably like John M. Burns, too. They just didn't know the book existed, or, you know, they didn't see the art or whatever. It's a shame.
Yeah, you know, it's those unique kind of books like that that I always fear for because, you know, they're running while Civil War or, you know, Infinite Crisis is going on at DC, and it is those kind of projects that I always feel deserve the attention because they're unique and end up, you know, not getting the attention. I'm really thrilled that at DC, Jonah Hex is doing as well as it is.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been able to get guys like Brunet and everybody to come on and you know, put their style on there. And even Luke Ross was doing really interesting stuff right from the start. So, you know, it's nice to see, and I'll throw Athena Voltaire in there as well, that, you know, comics should be about everything. They're books. At the end of the day, they're books. And if there's any, you know, possible story that should fit in, you know, any other type of medium, it should certainly fit in comics. And I'm glad to see that stuff like this is coming out.
Yeah, well, thanks for including us in that group. But, yeah, there's so much good stuff. You know, my soapbox moment for the night is sometimes on message boards when people lament, you know, the fact that we have one main distributor in comics or that the newsstand has gone away or any of this other stuff, you know, they talk about that and they say how this is like the worst time ever for comics. What do you want, crack? Yeah, I mean, if this is the worst time ever for comics, it's nobody's fault but our own, you know, the creators and the enthusiasts, because with the Internet, it's such a huge leveling field to get this stuff out there to people with all of the movies. And I mean, when you and I were kids, there was nowhere near this much licensing material, toys and bed sheets and stuff for kids. I mean, the properties are all there in front of people. The medium is there in front of people. If we don't take advantage of this and educate people on how great comics as both a medium and, you know, the genre of material that's done in it, if we don't educate people while we have this opportunity, it's nobody's fault but our own. Because I think it's a great time. I mean, you don't have to scour for back issues. You can, but you're not required to with how much material is available in trade.
That's true.
It's still new reader friendly. We just have to stop bitching about where there may have been missteps in the past and maximize on what we got now. That's my soapbox moment. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, and you, you know, starting the comic book online, and you're one of these success stories of starting with a webcomic and then finally, you know, getting to print and reaching out to the internet audience and obviously building enough of a one that Ape Entertainment, obviously starting with Speakeasy and then Ape Entertainment being able to come in when Speakeasy folded and give you guys a platform. Are there other avenues that are non-traditional that you guys have sought out that have, you know, ended up in resulting in building your audience?
I just think part of it was doing it on the web. You know, we were able to make our mistakes without quite as many people seeing it. But by the same token, doing it on the web, we kind of had to learn how to promote our own material. You know, in the early days, I would contact reviewers myself and always try to create some kind of presence so that, you know, people could know it was there. Because if you don't tell people you exist, they're not going to find out.
Sure.
So I don't know that we really capitalized or grabbed onto any new technology so much as it was a good way for us to learn how to do these things. Because, I mean, if you... Well, you've talked with Ed Brubaker. And if you look at all the stuff he did to promote Criminal, I don't understand indie people who say that it's the publisher's responsibility to promote your creator-owned material. I mean, if you own it, if you own the big stake of it, then you should be getting your hands dirty and doing it. And I think Brubaker is a great example of that because this guy works for, you know, his creator-owned material came out through Marvel's creator-owned imprint, and he rolled up his sleeves and told people that the book existed, and they responded. And on a smaller scale, that's what we were doing with the webcomic. And I think it was a great way to learn how to market your material for us, and, you know, hopefully we'll be able to apply that more and more.
Did you have to go back in collecting this for the trade and fix anything that you didn't like about the webcomics when they first came out?
I'm not copping to that.
It's so perfect.
Who, me? Just call me George Lucas. no, I fixed stuff, but there was so much stuff that I wanted to fix that we didn't have time to. There was a period there where I felt a lot more confident about drawing someone looking over their shoulder with a very extreme three-quarter view.
Okay.
I felt far more confident in my ability to draw it than my ability dictated.
Okay.
There were some really mushy faces. So I fixed a few of those up. And I know that Chad Fidler, he saturated a lot of the colors on it, too. I think we were a little more... I think Chad's palette got more sophisticated as he went along. And, you know, hopefully I've improved on the drawing end.
That's very cool. Well, as we wrap up, I want to point out again that Flight of the Falcon is coming out. Issue 4 is still on its way. And then what is the title for the webcomics collection?
It goes by the clever name, The Collected Webcomics. I'm just that clever.
It really is a great book, and I really enjoy good adventure fiction, and I'm glad to say that Athena Voltaire is a great example of it. So congratulations. I look forward to more. I look forward to whatever new non-Athena Voltaire subjects you guys, you know, come up with in the future, because you've got a good team there, and I look forward to see what's next from you guys.
Well, thanks, man. I love being on the show, so it was great. And, yeah, I'm available. Marvel, DC, anyone available here?
Yeah, no kidding. Let's see you on. I'd like to see you do a Nick Fury or something like that, man.
Oh, God, that would be my dream.
It's Athena Voltaire from Ape Entertainment. And it's a great production, and it's executed by three really good guys, and one of them is Steve Bryant. And I appreciate your time today, Steve.
Thanks, John.
A nice conversation with Steve Bryant, the creator of Athena Voltaire. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, more great episodes coming up from Word Balloon. Keep coming to our website, wordballoon.com, for more information. Also, don't forget, there's myspace.com/wordballoon, comicspace.com/wordballoon, and our podcasts are available via iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo, and all the other podcatchers you can think of.
We certainly would appreciate a review at iTunes or voting for us at places like Podcast Alley. We always appreciate the support. And if there's any questions you'd like to ask me, I'm always available online via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.